just truth of a head. It gets beyond all the headlines you read. Don't need lip service with a wink and a nod. You need a man on a mission from God. Well, not to worry, here's Bob in your life.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, the pastor of Denver Bible Church. With this hour, we will conclude our series on Columbine, The Crime Behind the Crime. Two families were victimized by Columbine, the murders at that high school, and also by law enforcement. I am here in studio with two fathers, one whose son survived, the other whose son didn't, who stood together and asked the question, why did this happen? And thereby, they uncovered the crime behind the crime. Welcome, Randy Brown.
Glad to be here, Bob.
And hi, Brian.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
We have been looking at the failure of the Jefferson County Sheriff's Department to prevent the Columbine murders that they should have been prevented, and then the cover-up afterward. And now, as we continue, we have been looking into the personalities involved in the Columbine murders, both those, the inept people in law enforcement and in the government education system leading up to Columbine, a crime that should have been prevented, and then afterward, the cover-ups and the lies. And we've seen that some of the people involved have gone on to relative obscurity, and other people have actually been rewarded, like a lawyer who did much of the lying for Jefferson County, who is now a judge, appointed by Republican Governor Bill Owens. When Lily Offler is one of the ones covering it up and she's handling the open records request, that just boils your blood.
It's perjury.
Yeah. And Randy, Brian and I, you know, some people call us maybe religious fanatics or something. But I think of Jesus Christ saying that every word, every deception, every action will be shouted from the housetops. They will not be able to hide forever the lies.
And I believe that. And what we're trying to do is hasten the process. But we don't have to be successful, ultimately, because right. It'll be known. But I do kind of like, you know, speeding it up a bit.
Oh, yeah.
Where possible. So we got Offler, Lieutenant John Kickbush. Now, he's no longer with Jeffco, and he really didn't want to cooperate with the grand jury.
Oh, to say the least. Fascinating. John Kickbush was a lieutenant at the time. And as a lieutenant, he actually had four felony arrests on his record and yet was still made a lieutenant in Jefferson County.
Which wow. is against all protocol.
Well, they were plea bargained down to something less, so...
Yeah. Well, the license plate one, this guy, tell me if I'm getting this story right, he used someone else's address to buy license plates so he didn't have to have an emissions test to
yeah,
pay less taxes.
Registered vehicle somewhere else.
Right.
And, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is how some of these people behave. We can do anything we want because we know the system, and after all, they won't touch us, and he's proof of that. No matter what you do, you can get away with it.
Well, and it's my understanding, again, that he destroyed files and – for a long time, I actually—
He ordered someone to destroy files, for sure. We know that factually.
I actually thought for a long time that Kickbush might have been behind this and might have been the instigating, you know, detective that was responsible. But we don't have enough information to be sure yet.
Seems to be a fairly tight-knit organization all the way through in terms of who's doing what. And there were an awful lot of people that took their marching orders and would do anything— to help the greater cause. And I still say it goes back to Thomas. Hmm. That's where everything points to me. And Kickbush is certainly a willing participant in all of this. And he probably had something to gain from this information not coming out. Deputy Dennis Gerlach.
Well, this is upsetting to me because we filed a couple internal investigation complaints at the Sheriff's Department trying to find out what happened to our report, why our report was closed out without our knowledge. And another investigation complaint against actually John Stone, Sheriff John Stone. And it turns out that Deputy Gerlach was the internal affairs officer who handled our complaints. And we didn't know at the time that he attended the secret meetings where they were conspiring to conceal the information. So we're turning in internal affairs investigations to someone who was at the secret meetings.
Well, that's exactly right. And again, this is kind of like when we get around to talking about the regulatory counsel for the attorneys, that the criminals are handling the investigation. And so you can see it clearly now.
Yes.
But at the time, the only avenues open were things like this.
Right. We have no other power than to file things like that.
Deputy Guerra, we know he was at the meeting. How about Lieutenant Jeff Schrader? He got a little reward, didn't he?
Well, he was made a division chief. You know, we actually went and talked to Lieutenant Schrader, who's now a division chief at Jeffco, and he appeared fairly honest, and I have to say I kind of liked the guy. And at the same time, he didn't really want to know anything about what had happened and kind of denied knowing that there was a meeting. So what the end result of that meeting was, I'm still not sure.
Well, I'll tell you what. He reminds me of Ray Flair, who's the undersheriff in Jeffco now,
right,
who stood and told you and I and your wife that they didn't know what the answers were and they didn't know if they could be found, but they'd help us.
Yeah,
it turns out he's at the secret meeting,
yes,
and there's no question in my mind he's the undersheriff as part of the deal Ted Mink took to become sheriff so that they could maintain their consistency in Columbine and that nothing would be released and no new information would get out if they could help it. And then when that report came out, they were all stunned that Salazar let that out and actually went to court to his credit because it's very unusual for a grand jury report to be released without an indictment.
Yes.
But Salazar went to court and told the judge, this needs to be out. It's a public interest, and I want it out. I want the court to release it, and fortunately, the court agreed to. So again, when you commend Salazar, there is more evidence to that. I'm just frustrated that he knows all the corruption, and he'd let it drop. County Manager Ron Holliday.
Well, this was fascinating, and this also, if the county manager is there and the county attorneys are there, what we've speculated for a long time is that the county commissioners were there too, but no one's ever confirmed that. Just like Sheriff John Stone at this meeting brought his attorney there. We don't know the name of his attorney still.
Right.
So it's disappointing that the county manager would be there, and I believe he still is the county manager, isn't he?
I don't know for sure. I was going to ask you about that. But yeah, when you put it in perspective, considering one of the county commissioners at the time, I mentioned Mike Zenna earlier, the county commissioner was sending fraudulent documents to Zenna, and Zenna was smart enough to go to court and get Kinko's to release their surveillance tapes from their cameras and prove that it was the county commissioners that were trying to set him up with false information so they could sue him for slander. And so that's the type of county Jefferson County is. And I agree with you that Ron Holliday almost certainly was there representing the county commissioners and there for their benefit, although we don't know for sure. It's speculation.
Well, I do have some information that kind of supports that. I went to the county commissioners at a commissioner meeting. And
they like you.
I don't think so. And I actually complained that Mr. Tuthill was in court representing the Harrises and the Klebolds, and the county commissioner's response was very simply that they're very happy with the job Mr. Tuthill was doing. So that seemed to me a very obvious endorsement of his actions.
Well, that would be certainly reasonable to assume that.
Yeah. To clarify that, this is when Jeffco is using tax dollars on behalf of the Harrison Klebold families to further keep things quiet.
Right.
Steve Davis, he was the public information officer of Jeffco. He stood in front of the cameras month after month, and he flat lied. He was at this meeting. He knew what they had, what they were concerned about, and in interview after interview after interview, he either played like he hadn't had the information shared with him or he flat lied. And guess what he's doing today?
He's a public information officer for Lakewood, I believe.
For Lakewood. But the fact that any sheriff's department in Colorado would let this man stand up in front and say, hey, trust me, I'm the information officer, is astonishing to me. He is a proven, confirmed liar.
Steve Davis did something that, in retrospect, just breaks my heart and breaks my wife's heart. They were having a press conference talking about Eric and Dylan and, you know, answering questions. And out of the blue, he offered, and this is when people were afraid, and they, Eric and Dylan, this was within a week of the murders. He offered that, by the way, he said, Brooks Brown, over the last few years, became very good friends with Eric Harris, and insinuating that Brooks had some involvement again.
That's guilt by association.
And offered that for no reason, and it's not on any of the documents they have. We don't know if he was told to say that or if he offered that on his own.
Oh, I'm sure this was a result of the meeting. They knew that you were the one person that might be able to expose him, and I can almost guarantee you at this meeting they talked about contingency plans.
And I'll tell you the luck that we could expose them. Well, along with the help of Brian, you've been incredible in trusting us and getting the truth out, but the luck that we could expose them in the beginning comes down to because we didn't have the police records anymore. We had the web pages but didn't have the police records. As I had just by accident or by chance written the case number in my daytimer. If we hadn't had that number, they wouldn't have been forced to admit that it existed. So
we had we also had the aid of some very fine people inside the Jefferson County Police Department.
That is true.
Who said, they're trying to destroy your family.
Yes.
They're lying to you. Here's what we can help you with.
And everyone who thinks that Brian and I bash the police, which isn't true, we're bashing the sheriff and the district attorney and the attorneys there for lying. There are a lot of brave policemen out there, and I will never forget that phone call from this man who was a policeman. I believe he put his life on the line making this phone call.
I agree with you.
That they would have killed him if they knew that he had, and his career absolutely would be over. We've never mentioned his name to this day. He has a code name of Sylvester.
Right.
And so we always talk about Sylvester, but we never talk about who he really is. What a brave gentleman this man was to come forward at a time when he knew that they were lying about us. He knew that it was lies, and he said, look, regardless, they will not make me lie. I will tell the truth. And I'm glad that we protected him for all these years because that level of courage should be rewarded. He was a brave man.
Absolutely. And it's sad that people like him can't be held up as a hero in society.
Yeah.
But they can't be.
But he's a hero and he knows it.
Yeah. I want to thank him too. Captain Harris, we know he was there. And of the list, we know these people were here for sure. We could speculate on a few others. I think Kate Batten and Randy West were also at the meeting, the ones who lied to my family. And, of course, you and I have asked in open records for a list of all the names of the people who were at this meeting, which was illegal for them to arrange this meeting and to conduct it. And we've asked for the notes and the minutes from the meeting. And, of course, none of those things have come yet.
No.
But we'll see what happens.
A lot is going to depend on the integrity that the current sheriff has, Ted Menk. He's now has to decide what he's going to release and if he's going to release the rest of the documents and the rest of the videos that tell some of the story and honestly tell some of the reasons why Eric did this, which if you don't understand why Eric Harris did this, you can't stop it from ever happening again. You can't solve a problem unless you know what caused it.
Well, and let's not forget his good friend and co-murderer,
Dylan
Klebold,
yeah.
Who, in my estimation, was every bit, if not more, wicked. And, of course, you're grasping at straws when you compare people this evil and mm-hmm. what they did, trying to say who's worse. But we can never forget that it was two of them. They both, with a great amount of joy, murdered innocent kids.
That's very true, Brian, very true.
So this is a sobering look back at what happened leading up to this murder spree that could have been prevented. Brian always corrects me. That should have been prevented.
That's what I was thinking too.
Yeah. And Randy Brown, it's because of you and your family that Jefferson County should have prevented Columbine, but they did not. And then the inactivity as the crime began to unfold was because we know they were looking at the Harris Klebold file, trying to figure out what to do, and then they immediately began to lie about its existence, and that went on for years. And so it's all crumbled, the facade for the most part that they built around trying to defend their actions has crumbled, and some have gone from being sheriff to a baker, and others have gone on to obscurity, but some have been promoted. But here at Bob and Yurt Live, we're a small voice. This show, this should be on 60 Minutes. That's what this should all be on. And a lot of this has been exposed in the media, but the public, it's not in their consciousness. They're not aware of the depth of the lies.
It's never been put together in a real-time context with what was happening at the moment versus what they knew at the time, along with how we now know they knew that. And that's what makes this so important, and I think why so many people are interested in it.
Mm-hmm. And as we did the shows for the 7th anniversary of Columbine, we received comments from all over the country. Thanks to our website, which Google and our website, we've staked out significant territory on the web. And so with the permission of both of you guys, we'll add this to our library, our archives of the true story of Columbine.
Fine with me.
Yep, that's good.
All right. Well, thank you both very much. And Brian, if it's all right, we'll proceed in the future and we'll do more of these shows. And Randy, thank you so much for coming.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's important that people understand what really happened.
In studio, we have Brian Rohrbaugh and Randy Brown, and we've been talking through what led up to Columbine, the crime itself, and the aftermath. And there are two things that I think we could look at: the Supreme Court, some of the things that happened at the Colorado Supreme Court, and the El Paso investigation.
Well, I want to start with a little bit about El Paso. We talked about them in a previous show. They did an investigation into my son's murder. They came up with a completely different conclusion than what Jeffco had told us. And in fact, they told me, we don't know why they lied to you, but they did lie to you. And in that investigation, some of the evidence we had used in our claim citing a wrongful death of my son and why we believed he had been shot by a police officer, that information came from a friend of my family, an Arapahoe County police officer named Jim Taylor, who stated that he was at the scene and witnessed my son die, and then 2.5 years later called me a liar and said he had never said that. Then there was a ton of ballistics evidence and physical evidence. In fact, we held a press conference one time, Randy, you were there, and we used a map, and we had a blue line on it. And the only shell casings, the only ballistics information below that line where Dan was, 100% of it came from the police. And so Jeffco didn't have any ballistics evidence or any fragments, even though they claimed they did. And then there was a lady who had, by chance, happened to talk to one of the police officers at Columbine, and she recounted that he had mentioned to her that he was concerned that an innocent kid had been shot by the police. And so El Paso, when they first started their investigation, went to her home, and her name is Selene Marquez. And Randy, why don't you tell us what you think of Selene and of her statements? And El Paso came out, if I remember correctly, and they said her statements were contradictory. In other words, they weren't reliable. They basically painted her in public as being a nutcase or a lunatic or a liar or scattered or something. Wouldn't you agree with that?
Oh, in the end, that's how they painted her, and the opposite is actually the truth. Selene Marquez is one of the bravest people I've ever met. She, at the time when no one would speak out, she spoke out and told the truth. She said what this one sergeant had said, Sergeant O'Shea said, that he thought he might have shot a child at Columbine, and Selene had the courage to come forward and say that. At the time, no one was doing that. Brian was speaking the truth, and some of the families were fighting for what was the truth, and some reporters were fighting for the truth. But Selene Marquez just came out of nowhere and told the truth, and it was an incredible act of courage, and she did tell the truth, too.
And she had nothing to gain but a lot to lose.
And she lost a lot. She lost her job. She lost her retirement for this. It ended up it hurt them a lot. But in the end, she told the truth, and I think that's something she should be very proud of. What is fascinating is going to the El Paso report and how it relates to Selene Marquez.
And let me just stop you for a second. After El Paso finished their investigation, we convinced them to give us all the materials
right
in the form they used them. And We didn't get everything, but we got most everything.
Right. Well, yeah.
And included in that were the interviews with different police officers and all of that. And you read every page of that, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, that was, yeah, the El Paso report, the CBI report. We've read all those, my wife right. and I, yes.
And so they said Selene Marquez gave contradictory statements, and they painted her publicly as being not credible, as someone who inserted herself into this for attention.
Yeah, that was a
lie. They did all of these things, and then you read the report, and you found documentation that what Selene Marquez said that this officer had said to other people. Who were some of the people? What was the one person that caught you by surprise who said the exact same thing as Selene Marquez?
Well, that officer's wife said exactly the same thing, and it was in the report almost word for word from what Selene was saying.
That's right. And El Paso knew it, and they intentionally destroyed her life,
yes,
her retirement, her employment, because she did the right thing. In other words, they said, if you ever dare question the police, you will pay a price.
I think they were sending a message to everyone that you can't challenge the powers that be. But
no matter what you know,
right,
you better keep your mouth shut.
But it was nevertheless a great act of courage for Selene Marquez to stand up and tell the truth and know that she was going to get flack. And reporters were standing on her yard and knocking on her door all hours of the day, and it wasn't anything she wanted. She had courage.
And she told the truth.
Yes.
And the statement she gave to me was absolutely 100% factual, and El Paso County confirmed it in every detail.
Yes.
And they stood up and they called her a liar.
Yeah, they used the inconsistent statement thing. They used that a lot whenever they want to discredit someone. So whenever you hear – they used it against Brooks. They said Brooks made inconsistent statements, which was fascinating to me because I had been at every interview and I knew he said almost exactly the same things or close to it. You can't repeat things word for word. You sometimes summarize one part and tell the rest of another. But there were no inconsistent statements that Brooks ever gave. And I have to tell you, I was there when Selene told you this and you tape recorded it, as I believe, and you also
right.
typed it out. And there were no inconsistencies in her statement at all, nor were there inconsistencies with what she said that night and what El Paso had in their report. It was the same thing. It was exactly the same thing.
They proved that she was honest.
Yes.
That she repeated exactly what she had been told in context as it related to the entire Columbine massacre.
Yes.
And then they punished her publicly, and they never told the press. And unless someone in the press wanted to sit down and read this report,
yeah,
which they didn't,
no,
they destroyed this woman. And this is what we've been fighting all these years. And I thank God for Selene Marquez and
yes,
people like her who have stood up and taken the risk. But I'm really saddened and angered by what they did to her. There was no reason for it.
No.
You know, she was honest. She made nothing up. She wasn't trying to help me. She wasn't trying to hurt me.
No.
She was trying to say there is a truth. And it's time that we talk about it.
Well, and early in the El Paso report, it says the things about Selene and how she made inconsistent statements. And then later on in the same report, they put in that this sergeant's wife said pretty much the same thing, not exactly, but the same thing. And yet they discredit Selene but leave the stuff in about Sergeant O'Shea's wife. It was fascinating.
Right. And they didn't put in the report that she didn't get her story straight.
No.
No, they took her at her word.
Yes. There's more in the El Paso report that's actually fascinating. They come up with a different conclusion from Jefferson County. And at the time, I even wrote El Paso a letter saying, you know, hey, you know, be careful what you come up with because I'm going to review it, you know, and there are people that know what's going on here, at least as much as we were allowed to know. Well, they came up with a different conclusion than Jeffco. But to do so, Jeffco had to release further information to El Paso that they had never released to us. So, for example, the famous 911 tapes that we've wanted to hear and we've wanted copies of for years, they say are not reproducible and they can't get us a copy. They used specific segments of these in their investigation and they let us hear them, but you'd hear a 3-second bite and a 1-second bite, So they had them, and they had them where El Paso could listen to them.
And they had time stamping, which was the thing they said they never had. We talked about that in a previous show of just how corrupt it is that this behavior has gone on all this time. And there's still a big suspicion that there's something else hidden because of the way this is orchestrated. And, you know, shame on you, Sheriff Anderson, for doing that to Selene Marquez.
I agree.
That was wrong. And you should have had enough integrity and enough decency not to hurt someone innocent who was an honest citizen doing the right thing, who told you the truth.
That family and that woman, that's a brave family. They didn't deserve what happened to them.
And since we do have Randy Brown in the studio, Randy, thinking about El Paso investigation, is there anything else that you have your own insight or that catches your attention from El Paso's effort to look at what Jeffco did, and they gave their supposedly independent report that was not very independent?
Not independent at all. They reported back to Jeffco every single day.
And as Brian knows, we could go on about this report and what I would like to know about it, like could I have access to all the files they saw to come to the conclusions they came to, because we've never been given access to those. But the biggest thing that came from this was a goof-up. Jefferson County gave El Paso copies of the investigative reports, and these are page numbered. It's Bates stamped is what they call it, but every page has a number. And what we found is that they released pages to Jefferson County with, as an example, page 35,180 on it, that to us was page 13,100. So what Jefferson County had, and it was proven by the release of the El Paso report, because we had identical pages with different stamping page numbers, Jefferson County is like someone cheating the IRS. They have two or three sets of books, and they release whatever they want to us. But when it was important and it was necessary to clear a sheriff, they released everything to them. And that is factual, proven, cannot be argued with. I've documented that. I took that to Salazar. And matter of fact, thanks to Brian, I was appointed to and the families, I was appointed to the Attorney General's records task review force, whatever they called it.
And yeah, their task force. And let me just say something about that. On that task force was Dave Thomas and Kathy Sasek, and also Kate Batten and Lily Offler. Well, Kate Batten and Lily Offler dropped off when it became apparent that they couldn't stall records releases, and they said it was a conflict. But Thomas and Sasek stayed there the entire time, and that's really important to understanding why Salazar with the grand jury went to get that report released, because these people had been lying to him just like they lied to me.
Yes.
Now, I don't know that he cared that they lied to me, but he really cared that they lied to him.
Oh, and it was proven that they lied to him. I think that would be upsetting. Back to these pages, we gave them this information clearly that, look, here is the same page with two different numbers on it. And I think I had 50 examples of that, so it wasn't just an error. It was something they had planned, and that just never would go anywhere. They would never investigate to find out why that happened. And I said it was very simple. You know, let us go in, let Brian and I, my wife, and Alan Prendergast and Kevin Vaughn, the people that are investigating this, go into the sheriff's vault and let us look at the pages and let us see what you've hidden from us. And they will never do that.
Kevin Vaughn, a reporter at the Rocky Mountain News.
Yes, right. Alan Prendergast at Westward.
Right.
And the current sheriff of Jeffco, Mink, he has said that he wanted you and the families to have access to all the information, all the evidence.
We have another recording. We're not going to play it now, where he committed to me, Randy, and Judy to put all the evidence on a table and let us look through it and have people there that if we had questions could find the answer. And he made that commitment. Of course, that was one more lie in a long history of Jefferson County.
That's been a couple years. That hasn't happened, yeah.
Next thing, the Supreme Court of Colorado has this regulatory committee. And what their job is to be sure that the fine attorneys that we're hiring to represent us as a county or as an individual are upholding the highest standards of ethics and that they're obeying the laws governing their practice. And you had a dealing with them, as I recall. Could you tell us about that?
Oh, yes. Five attorneys attended the secret meetings. Once I found that out, and I can't remember if someone suggested this or if I did this on my own, it's sometimes details get lost. But I read through the regulations regarding attorneys, and there was a rule in there that was a very important rule that basically says you cannot conceal information from an opposing attorney in a court of law. That's a violation of their code of ethics. And since these five attorneys had attended this secret meeting and conspired to conceal this information from Brian and his attorney and other families and their attorneys, that seemed like the most obvious violation of one of these rules that you could ever have. It was a clear violation of the simple rule.
Right. And Randy, as you're telling this, just thinking about it, there's no way the Colorado Supreme Court could enforce that because the entire system would unravel. It would all unravel because that's their stock in trade is lying in court. That's what happens.
Well, but that's still their rules. So,
right.
I mean, if they have rules, they should follow the rules.
Oh, yeah,
so,
they should.
So we went to a great deal of work and filed a specific complaint against Thomas, Sasek, Hutchless, Tuthill, and Offler, the five attorneys who attended the secret meeting. 50-page complaint spelling out exactly what the rule says, what they had done, how they had attended the secret meeting, how Attorney General Salazar had clearly shown they attended the secret meeting, how some of the people there said the purpose of the meeting was to conceal information, and we turned this in to them. And this was a fascinating 6-month process. I thought it would be relatively quick, and it wasn't. A man named Mortimer, I think it's Chip Mortimer, and I have to tell you I like this guy, and I also have to tell you I think he did his job. He tried to put this case together, and I am certain, and this I'm saying this knowing I'm going to hurt Chip Mortimer's career, but I'm certain that the man in charge of this Judiciary Review Committee, Mr. Gleason, was simply told politically, this is going nowhere. These attorneys are not going to lose their license. They lied to protect the county, and you're not going to punish them for it, and that was it. And that's how it ended up after a number of requests back for details and me turning things in.
Let me add a little bit to that. Alan Prendergast of Westward spent an afternoon with him, giving them material, facts, court documents, all kinds of data. So they had that. I spent some time with him, and in fact, I have a recording of that. And so maybe Mortimer's a good guy, maybe he's not. It doesn't matter. They selectively enforce these rules. If
right.
this had been against an attorney they didn't like or a political stance they didn't like, they might have enforced them.
Yes.
But the truth of the matter is it wasn't just one rule they violated. There was a bunch.
Oh,
and
true.
You well documented true. That, including flat lying in court. And you remember
right.
they got the transcripts from the court.
Yes.
And there's no denying
yes.
they were lying in court.
Yes.
I played recordings of Dave Thomas flat lying about things that he knew to be true because that was the thing that Mortimer said was the most severe, that if he lied to you about something he knew for sure,
right.
you know, that's where we draw the line
right.
kind of thing.
Right.
So I played him the recordings. So maybe in another show somewhere down the road, we'll review that. But this was a very serious complaint. It was very well put together. And so I think the audience by now is going to predict what the outcome of the complaint was.
Yeah.
But why don't you tell us?
Well, Mr. Gleason sent me a letter. And you're right. Thank you for reminding me, Brian. This was much more complex than just the one violation. There were many others. But Mr. Gleason notified me by mail that not only were they not going to find them at fault, they weren't even going to have a hearing. I couldn't even attend an investigatory hearing on them while they were in the room. There wasn't even going to be a hearing. He found them blameless without a hearing.
Do you remember that they admitted that these people were deceptive? In other words, they lied to us?
Actually, yes. One of the comments was, I believe, and this is just from memory, that this was about Mr. Tuthill, that he may have lied to the victims' families, but in doing so, he was performing his duties as the county attorney. And that was dumbfounding to me that these people pay taxes in this county. These county attorneys should be representing them, not working against them and lying to them. And again, I still am actually – I get very upset about all this stuff. That they can lie to the families of murdered children. Their children were murdered in a school, that they can lie to them when they're just trying to find out the truth and get away with it and not lose their license over that and have no repercussions, I think is phenomenal. It's sad.
It's an indictment that obviously I asked earlier, why would higher levels of government be motivated to cover up? And so that indictment brings it right to the Colorado Supreme Court. We've talked about the governor. And
yes.
it's the system doing its best to protect the system years before Columbine. We live in Arvada, Colorado. We have friends in Jefferson County Sheriff's Department. And we talked about for years before Columbine how the slogan of the department was cover yourself. That's the slogan. The slogan is not protect the innocent, do right. It's cover yourself. And that continues to this day by people at Jefferson County who they go in thinking, hey, I signed up for a paycheck not to risk my life to save innocent people.
In their defense on that, I have a number of policemen friends who have told me, and I believe them, that now their first responder methods are different, that they are told they don't care how dangerous it is for you. You don't stand outside and listen to children be murdered. You go in and you get that shooter. And he tells me that that has changed all over the country. Now, we have asked to see that as a written policy in Jefferson County, and it doesn't exist so far.
Brian, I've heard people say, it's hard to believe, but that Jefferson County Sheriff's Department had a policy that says in a live shooter situation like this, the officers on the scene are not supposed to go in to try to kill or stop the shooters, but they're supposed to form a perimeter and wait.
Believe it or not, there really is a policy like that.
Really?
It allowed them to call SWAT. It should have never been there. It was a wicked thing. The whole problem with SWAT is that it tells you you don't have to do your job. You can wait for someone specialized to do it. The problem with it is if you had a hostage situation, you might be able to argue that that's acceptable. But this was murders, real-time shootings. They knew it. They witnessed it. And there's no way in the world that anyone can argue that this was the first time that this had come up and that they needed some new policy. The reality is the first few people on scene were flat cowards. They allowed the sacrifice.
If the policy was, and thank you, Brian, for having this information and knowing this, the policy is you got to wait for SWAT. Then when SWAT got there, why didn't they then?
Of course, you're right. But it's not that you have to wait for SWAT. It was an option. Mm. But the reality is, long before Columbine, there were live shooter events. And the police who got there first hid behind this as kind of an option. But there is no excuse for their behavior. Once you get beyond them, you're dealing with people who really wanted to do something. Mm. But the first handful of people there were flat cowards. And they witnessed children being murdered. And they did nothing but retreat.
And they listened to it for longer than they should have, to say the least.
And so, you know, along with that, of course, they had the real-time 911 call from the library. There was a ton of evidence. And I will say once again, most of the officers on scene were good people who would have, I believe, risked serious injury or death to stop the crime.
I agree.
Unfortunately, that wasn't the first people who arrived there. And then when you get people like Neil Gardner, who was the cop assigned to Columbine, and you look at his behavior, how he was the expert at the layout of the school, and they couldn't find him to tell SWAT how the school was laid out. When you look at all the cowardly activities, you know, you look at the woman, Annette Walker, who's now Annette Smoker, who lied to Rich and Sue and six other people that Dan was holding a door open and he was a hero when they knew that wasn't true, and then told El Paso that Rich and Sue were liars.
That's the story of trying to get justice from the Colorado Supreme Court, and that fell through. So are there other parts of the story, Brian?
You know, with the Supreme Court, I just want to point out that they did exactly what you say, Bob. They followed the process. And so the process is far more important than the end result.
Than
the
truth.
Just follow the process.
Right. And that doesn't mean they follow the process when it leads to a just result.
Oh, no, not at all.
There are so many rules, so many conflicting rules, so many unwritten rules that the judges will do whatever they feel like doing to bring about their politically correct view of the world.
Well, and I actually have a different perspective on that. I believe that the Judiciary Review Committee did not follow the process. They clearly should have had a hearing and should have disbarred these attorneys for attending this secret meeting.
Yeah.
It's a clear violation of many of their rules.
Right.
It's still unbelievable to me that we never even got a disciplinary hearing on one of these attorneys that attended this secret meeting.
Randy,
they conspired to conceal information from the parents of murdered children and from their attorneys. That should be a disbarment offense.
Right. You're exactly right. And let me clarify. We've said this many times on the air. The process is not only the millions of laws and rules we have, but then all the unwritten rules. And when we point out the obsession is with the process, as in contrast to right and wrong and to the truth and to justice, so that since their commitment, the commitment of our judges and lawyers is that it's not justice, it's not right and wrong, it's the process. When you make that kind of a commitment as the guiding force for your whole life, you no longer care about right and wrong.
Right.
You don't care about justice. And so you'll use the unwritten rules, which is, hey, you cover up for another law enforcement agency.
Yes.
So that becomes the prevailing principle at that moment.
Or in this case where Governor Owens simply called and said, that goes no further.
Well, thank you. Okay.
Yeah, thanks for giving us the opportunity.
You're very welcome, Randy Brown. And Brian Werbaugh, thank you, Brian.
Thanks, Bob.
We'll be back right after this.
At Bob Inyart Live and KGov.com, you'll find literature, audio, and video products that are a must for the library of any Christian interested in studying the truth of the Bible. You'll find essential material like the plot manuscript, an overview of the whole Bible that will clear up doctrinal issues. Then there's The Tree, a fun audio journey back to the Garden of Eden, where you'll learn about this most famous tree and its impact on humanity. Check out the Mount Moriah video. This video gives evidence for the resurrection, combining biblical and secular resources. It's a great witnessing tool. And don't forget the death penalty video. Learn that Jesus advocated the death penalty and learn how God put the death penalty at the heart of the gospel. You can directly help Bob's outreach by subscribing to Best of Bob, Bob's Best 8 Shows of the Month, or build a Bible study library by ordering the monthly Bible albums. There's a lot more, so give us a call at 1-800-8-INYARD. That's 1-800-836-9278. 1-800-836-9278 or KGOV.com.
This is Bob Inyart inviting you to read our manuscript, The Plot, for an overview of the whole Bible. Call us at 800-836-9278. That's 836-9278. Wow, that was powerful. If you would like to comment on anything you've just heard in these Columbine shows, please feel free to call in on a future program of Bob Inyart Live. I'd love to hear your thoughts. And since this show is not over yet, we have more time, I want to turn back the clock, go into our archives, and play for you a show we did in December of 2000 when the Denver Post was trying to get the autopsies of the students who were killed at Columbine. And, of course, some of the parents were devastated. And Danny Rohrbaugh's stepdad, Rich Petrone, was at court and had a bit of a confrontation with a lawyer for the Denver Post. So that made the media, and then we got him on this program. So now you'll be able to make it out. The audio's not great, but it's good enough to hear and enjoy. So now let's go back to 6 years ago. We've got on the line here Rich Petrone, who is one of the Columbine dads. His stepson, Daniel Rohrbaugh, was murdered. And Rich has been reported in the Rocky Mountain News to have an angry confrontation with the Denver Post reporters at a courthouse this past week. Rich, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. How about you?
Thank you for joining me on this last-minute notice.
That's okay.
Rich, tell me what happened.
Well, the confrontation was with the Denver Post lawyers.
Right.
We were sitting in a courtroom because the Denver Post wants the autopsies of our kids made public.
Why in the world would they ever ask for that?
Well, because they think they have a right to it because it's public. It's a public thing, and they have the right to look it over and do their thing with it.
You know, the Rocky Mountain News has requested only the autopsy report on one of the murderers,
yep,
Dylan Klebold. And a judge has previously released the report on Eric Harris, and they're the murderers. And in fact, their autopsies might tell us some interesting and valuable things, like Harris had a T-shirt that said natural selection.
and which shows how they worship the concept of evolution and that we're just animals.
Yep.
But why in the world would the media want the autopsies?
Well, and that's the case. You know, what they say is it's public record. They have a right to know because they'd like to look at them and make their own decision.
Well, how about parents who don't want their kids' brutal murders to be splashed again in the headlines regarding what they had in their pockets?
Well, the thing that they wanted to do is they want to look at it because, you know, they're saying that they need to, the public needs to know that stuff, which I'm saying the public, we're all saying the public doesn't need to know.
Of course not.
And the judge already ruled last summer, ruled that they should be sealed because of the fact that it would have a big impact on the community. And that's what the state law reads.
Mm-hmm.
That they're appealing it. And but during the case, we had people talking, and the lawyer, they had these two lawyers, one and then there's another one, right? And all during the hearing, he's in there smirking and laughing every time his lawyer made a case, you know, a point.
Right.
And I'm sitting there, and I'm just getting my tempers up, to, you know.
Right, because here are parents that are still hurting because their kids were killed, and they're saying, well, we'd like at least this last moment of their life to be kept with some privacy and dignity.
Like raping them in their graves is what it would be like. That's what I look at it as.
Yeah, and he's sitting in the courtroom for the Denver Post. This was a
this was a lawyer's assistant lawyer.
And they're smirking.
And laughing.
With the parents right there in the room.
Yep, and the other ones, they're cracking like joke type things. Not jokes, but little humorous things. And then, but the thing that really, I'm listening to these people talking about how it won't affect the community and that maybe a few would be affected, like the families. But the harm that it would do us would, by releasing them, would way overdo what it would do for the benefit of them to sell their newspapers, basically.
Right, exactly.
And even though we mentioned that there's been suicides in the school and that, well, you don't know they're connected with that. Like, oh, yeah, right.
What idiot lawyers. We despise lawyers anyway. This just helps.
Well, yeah, and they are. They're just, all they are is they want their money, and they don't look at what it does for people. And that's why I think a lot of this stuff goes on today.
What suicide? I know one of the kids' moms committed suicide. Do I have that right?
One of the kids' moms, that was made public. And then one of the kids that was a basketball player that was in the science room.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing is, there's been other suicides in the school that you don't hear of.
Oh.
The school district is very evil. They keep things closed.
Right.
Well, there's another story on that one, too. But on this issue, so in the courtroom, this guy, this lawyer, this moron says that the picture of, you know, the Oklahoma City bombing, right?
When
the Oklahoma City bombing, the little baby that was carried out, her name is Bailey. They carried her out of the fire.
Baby Bailey.
Yep, that was dead. The fireman had him. He says that he could see that picture now and it doesn't affect him like it did 5 years ago.
Oh, brother.
That's when I said, we were in the courtroom, and I said it loud enough for people behind me to hear. The judge didn't hear it. But I just said that the guy was heartless, you know. And
yeah, he says he sees that picture of the fireman carrying this little baby, and he says, that doesn't affect me.
Doesn't affect him. So I went out in the hall, and I'm sitting there thinking, well, I even stayed in the back room because Sue was composing herself. After the hearing, my wife was crying and just sobbing, right?
Yeah, and she's sitting, and you know, sometimes guys are a bit tougher than women, but your wife is there in the courtroom, and they're making this absurd and brutal, heartless argument in front of these moms of kids who were murdered.
Oh, yeah, it just set them all back, you know, a couple days, especially this time of year, more than a couple days. But, you know, it just sets them back. She's crying, so she composed herself. We walk out. Well, I'm sitting there, and I'm burning inside. I'm shaking. I'm so mad. So I see this guy. I went up to him, and I said, look it. I said, you might be laughing and you think it's funny, smirking over there. I said, it took everything in my power to keep me in my chair. I said, you're sitting there, and I said, these are our kids you're talking about.
Aww.
The human lives, innocent people who did nothing to nobody, and you're acting like they're nothing. He goes, well, I apologize. I said, well, I don't care. You don't really apologize or you wouldn't be here.
He's a liar. The Rocky Mountain News said that you confronted the Denver Post attorneys saying, you guys are so heartless, it makes me sick.
That's what I said to the main attorney when he was there. He was getting ready for his interview, sitting there all Mr. Prim and Proper, like he's so cool, you know. And I just said to him, I said, You are so heartless, you make me sick to my stomach. If you don't know what that, and they didn't go on to say, I said, if you don't know who that baby is, I said, you have no heart, and he doesn't. And then Sue told him, she yelled across the room, yeah, do you even know that baby's name? Her name is Bailey.
No.
Do you know our kids' names? Do you even know one victim that your autopsy?
No.
And that's what Sue yelled to him. And that didn't make the paper. They always put me on because I'm kind of psycho. But that's well, I get mad at people. But I'll tell you what, Bob, it was everything I could do to not. And then after I left, I just told Sue I wanted to. I mean, it was like I could have threw that guy through that window if I didn't walk away from him.
Rich, a long time ago, my audience heard from your friend and my friend, Brian Rohrbaugh, regarding taking down the crosses on Rebel Hill. Can you do you have another moment? Could you just briefly tell the audience what happened from your perspective?
Well, we were out of town at the time. We did. Oprah wanted to talk to us after Dan's funeral. So Sue, we went out there and she did a little special on Columbine, which Sue's idea was to get people to know who Danny was. You know,
right?
Not just from what they hear from the paper. She wanted to be able to say it, and Oprah does a good thing about getting that stuff out.
Right.
So she went. We went there on the way. When we got home, Brian calls and says that there's some crosses up on Rebel Hill, and there's 15 of them. I go, 15? So we were like mad. Brian was up there, you know, arguing with them all a couple of days, I guess.
Now, 15 is horrendous because there were 13 victims and two murderers.
Yep, they put two murderers up there. And Bob, while we're on this subject, let me tell you what I saw before we, well, when I'm done, remind me to tell you about Life Magazine, okay?
Life Magazine, will do.
So anyway, we sit there, and I called all the people I know at the sheriff's department that I knew prior to this and the people that we knew in law enforcement to see if they can do something about it. Nobody would do anything about it because they didn't want to get, you know, they didn't want to look bad in the public eye.
Now, they've got a memorial to two murderers, and they won't do anything about that on public property.
So we went, and Brian and I, we and my father-in-law, my brother, and Brian, we went and took them down. And we're going up the hill to take them down. There's a lot of people out there. And we're looking at them, watching people. I saw people, honestly, Bob, going up to these evil crosses, these people, and saying that they were, they're looking at them, and they're forgiving them, forgiving these people for murdering these 13 people.
Right.
And so I sat there. I go, oh, this just made us mad. So Brian says, well, we're going to take them down. So we went. And Brian and I grabbed one, and my father-in-law, my brother grabbed one. We're going down the hill. Brian says, what are we going to do with them? I asked Brian, what are we going to do with them? He said, well, we'll bring them to your house. So we bring them to our garage, and I tell you, the evil off them you can feel it in your stomach.
Yeah.
It was so evil, and there was so much, the stuff that they wrote on them, their friends wrote on them, you are forgiven, and all this kind of stuff. So we chopped them up, and we threw them away.
You put them in a better place.
Yep, and they're where they belong. And one of my aunts was here from New Jersey. Said you should have took them and threw them in their parents' front yard and burned them.
Oh no!
Because you know, but they're evil. But there's no room in this. This is why our society is. In fact, I was looking through some the other day. We were looking through the paper in the back in the archives of the Denver Post for some information for one of our lawsuits.
Yeah,
picked up an article where a woman. They were talking about the 15 crosses, and this woman says. It's like it tells you it's a resemblance of our community or something like that. It's a reflection of our community that we would put up 15 crosses here to forgive, to reach out and forgive the two victims that did the murdering.
You know what is a symbol of our community?
What happened?
That 13 murdered people were killed in a public school. That's the symbol of our community.
And that's what I wish I would have got that lady's name on there because I would have called her and told her, yeah, because our community thinks that way is why this happened.
Right, right. Very good point. And in a way, she's right. That is a symbol of our community, that we no longer distinguish between innocents and murderers.
Well, now we're in King Super's there today. Time Magazine or Time Life has this book for the century, okay?
Yeah,
I'm looking in there. I thought, well, Columbine definitely will be in there. I'm looking to make sure there's not one certain picture in there. But I open it up. Guess what they have a picture of, Bob? They have a picture of Dylan Klebold, the murderer's cross.
You're kidding me.
There's a community in Littleton with 15 crosses for the 15 victims. They actually...
No, come on. No, Rich, they don't say that.
Yep, I saw that in the paper. I mean, in that book. I told Sue, I'm not ready to throw that book in the ground.
Oh, my.
I mean, I'm looking at, I just saw that was 2 days ago at King Supers. I could about die. I don't understand people, Bob.
These despicable, filthy creatures.
Well, that's Time. That's part of Time magazine.
Hey, Rich, but it's not only the pagan God haters at Time Life. It's also the Christians in the big, beautiful churches around Columbine.
Oh, yeah. The one we had, the one church up the road, West Bowles Community Church. The evil church, I call it.
The evil church.
Yeah, they put up those 15 trees.
Hey,
they
Rich.
They wanted to put 15 trees up.
Right, Rich.
To bring dignity to the murderers.
Yeah, Rich, and so people in the audience know, live around the country, people who don't live near Columbine, West Bowles Community Church is your typical evangelical Protestant church.
Yes, it is.
It's not, you know, it's not even like a United Methodist church, or it's just sort of like a typical church.
It's a big money church. They have a lot of people, and they have a large youth group there, and God, I feel bad for those kids in that youth group because they're teaching them that these murderers were victims.
Well, Cassie Bernal went there.
Yep, Cassie went there.
And the story about Cassie saying, yes, I do, that came from West Bowles youth pastor, and it turns out to be not a true story.
Yeah, I mean, the guy over there, he's really got an ego. And when we went ahead there with the trees, we heard Brian and Lisa were in one of the services prior to, and they said that they were going to do 15 rocks or something for these bring dignity to the victims. It was 15, and Brian and Lisa yelled at him and told them, they didn't yell at him, but they said, that's not right. Well, I guess they yelled at him. But we had a meeting with them. They promised us they would not do 15 of anything.
In other words, you guys met with the senior pastor of West Bowles Community Church, right?
Prior to.
And he promised there would be no memorial, they would not memorialize 15.
Nope, they wouldn't do it. That they didn't believe with us, but they said we agreed to disagree.
They said, we don't agree with you. We think we should do 15.
But we won't because we don't want to bring further harm to the family.
We don't want to hurt the families who've already suffered. And Brian and Lisa were sitting in the church when they made the announcement.
Yep, and then we were there. We had a meeting with them for over an hour one night. So then one of the kids from the youth group, who was a friend of Dan's, came over and said that, Rich, they put 15 trees up at West Bowles Community. So I thought, you got to be kidding. So we went and we counted them. Sure enough, there's 15 linden trees sitting there. So we called him, and I said, Dave, what are you doing? I said, you promised.
What's his name, Dave?
Dave McPherson. And I said, what are you doing, Dave? I said, you're going to put those trees up after we told you not to?
After he agreed not to.
He goes, well, we thought it over, and we thought we were going to do what we wanted to do. That, you know, this is what we decided to do. So they went up, put them up.
So giving his word to him meant nothing.
Oh, he doesn't even know what giving his word means.
Even giving his word to grieving parents, I know that Lisa Rohrbaugh was in there, Sue Patrone, your wife, was in there.
Well, I had the meeting. It was Brian and I and Sue and Lisa. And he promised us he wouldn't do it.
Hey, you know what was interesting? After you guys cut down the trees, which we'll get to in a minute, then what happened in the media afterward that Brian and Dave McPherson appeared on different talk shows locally, and McPherson admitted that he promised they wouldn't do a memorial to 15 people.
Yep.
He admitted he promised you guys that, and then he said these parents had no right to tell us what property.
Yep.
As though he's forgetting that he gave his word in the Bible. God elevates that as one of the highest principles. When you give your word, even if later it turns out to really hurt you, you have to abide by your word or you are a liar.
Well, thank you, guys. And you out there in the audience, if you'd like to hear Brian's talk he gave at a medical ethics conference, then call us at 800-8-NER to order that on audio CD or to watch his DVD. He was the keynote speaker at the Colorado Right to Life March this year. It was extraordinary. You'll enjoy it. So give us a call.